Stay tuned now for Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, the collaborative series between 98.7 WFMT, Chicago Magazine, and the Looking Glass Theater Company in the Water Tower Waterworks. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by MavenChronicles.com. Let them take you somewhere. And by Seminary Co-op Bookstores. For readers, the Seminary Co-op Bookstores are a literary slice of heaven, because this consumer-owned bookstore is actually three Chicago bookstores: the flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue, widely regarded as one of the world's best academic bookstores, carries about 200,000 titles. Currently, they recommend Martha Nussbaum's Liberty of Conscience, in defense of America's tradition of religious equality, just released by Basic Books. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a charming neighborhood bookstore that's featuring Franny Billingsley's first picture book, Big Bad Bunny, newly published by Simon & Schuster. And the Newberry Library Bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in cartography, music, history, cards, gifts, and more. Discover Mapping Manifest Destiny, Chicago and the American West, by Michael Konzen and Diane Dillon, published by the Newberry Library. Enjoy Seminary Co-op Bookstore's 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, and author events. Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456 and semcoop.com. Victoria Lautman's guest today is Richard Price, whose book, Lush Life, will be the topic of discussion. We go now to the stage of Looking Glass Theater. Here is Victoria Lautman.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, and welcome to Writers on the Record. I'm Victoria Lautman. This is our fourth and sadly final season of this terrific collaboration between Chicago Magazine, WFMT, held here every month live at Looking Glass Theater. We still do, besides today, Richard Price, have two more authors coming up. We have Elizabeth Strout next month, followed by Alexandra Heyman in May. And I do want to say that for those of you who think they might miss this or feel that they've missed something for the last 4 years, every one of these interviews for the last 4 years is archived on victorialautman.com. You can laugh at them or, you know, use them to put you to sleep. But Edvige Danticat, Augustine Burroughs, Jay McInerney, Martin Amis, Anne Lamott, everybody starting from 4 years ago. So they will be there in perpetuity long after this show is just, you know, a dream of or a nightmare in some people's minds. Anyway, you probably have noticed that in the last couple of weeks, reviewers around the country have been in an absolute tizzy over Richard Price's eighth novel, Lush Life. They've really sort of been falling all over themselves with well-deserved praise for this incredible book. But there's also been some surprising comparisons, I thought. First of all, good old Dostoevsky was evoked in a review early on, before the book even came out, which led then to everybody was trying to sort of overdo the next statement about it. Richard Price writes dialogue better than Plato, which was followed by, that was a good one, someone likened the novel to Rent, rewritten by Balzac, which then culminated with this: Lush Life is the savage love child of Emile Zola and Mickey Spillane. But, you know, Richard Price actually declared himself to be the Fonzie of literature. That was back in 1981, after his first hit novel, The Wanderers, but before his groundbreaking novel, Clockers, in 1992. Mind you, you probably realize Price has had an impressively broad writing career and pedigree. It includes novels such as Freedomland and Samaritan. There are screenplays for The Color of Money, Sea of Love, Ransom. Of course, scripts for HBO's The Wire, which is ending tonight. And my personal favorite, Michael Jackson's music video, Bad, from 1987. There's Price's name in the credits, right along with Martin Scorsese. We are very fortunate to have Richard Price here today on Writers on the Record. Thank you. Thanks.
People, the bad video seems to have made a reappearance in all of your press material.
Oh, thanks to YouTube.
I'm on, aren't I?
Yeah, you're okay.
In defense
of when I call myself the Fonzie of literature, I was doing an awful lot of drugs.
Well, a lot of people, I think a next generation might not even realize what that means, the Fonzie of literature.
They might.
Although I have to say also, and I would have asked this a little bit later on, but I think you're the only author I can think of. I've talked to many authors who I'm sure have had drug issues and probably are still having substance abuse issues. You're the only one for whom that seems to appear all the time in concert with the press material. And I wonder if at some point somebody realized, actually, this is going to help Richard Price's street cred if we mention that he had like a little drug issue 20 years ago.
I don't know. It all came about because of Clockers, because it was part of the publicity package, the fact that I had had a problem. And, you know, like every other, you know, middle-class idiot in New York with sniffing coke, but it was just because of the subject of Clockers, which was, you know, the crack epidemic. They somehow packaged it into the publicity package, and that's all I hear, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, I didn't do any more than anybody else I knew. And so I called my parents in Florida the other day, and because there was a write-up in the New York Times about me, and they mentioned the drugs. And my mother thought she was talking to my brother, and she starts yelling, like, what's this cokehead stuff? I go, hi, it's not Randy. It's Richard. Oh, hi.
Well, Lush Life is not so much about drugs at all. And although it's interesting, when you synthesize all the reviews, it seems as though a lot of reviewers have had a difficult time figuring out what to place this, what genre to put this in. Some have called it a crime novel, a thriller, a murder mystery. And actually, none of those really, I think, give justice to what the depth and the expanse of this book. It seems to be that you might have used elements of each of those genres to kind of suck in the reader, but then use those genres as applying to something so much bigger and deeper than any of those genres individually.
Yeah, listen, I've discovered a couple of books ago that when I want to write about a really complex landscape, and I don't want it to sound like a travelogue, you know, especially with the Lower East Side, because there's about six different cultures down there. So I don't want to come off like the Marlon Perkins of humans, you know. That if there's a homicide and you follow an investigation and it's chronological, it's orderly, it's a great horse to ride. I never see my stuff in the mystery section of a bookstore. Occasionally I do, and I just flip. I mean, I don't care who did it. You know,
I'll tell you in
a jacket flap who did it. Just it's at worst a why did it, you know. But it's just a convenience for me. There's a lot of police stuff in there, but it's really, you know, it's a lazy man's way to a plot. Follow an investigation.
Well, in this particular book, unlike I think any of the other books that you've done, although, as you say, you have used this crime, a murder, a mugging gone bad, as the horse you ride in through what you've described as the Byzantine landscape of this changing Lower East Side, the book is really almost a ghost story about the Lower East Side. That was the story you wanted to tell, and this was the way that you could tell it.
Right. See, well, the Lower East Side, you know, in 1900, in the Jacob Riis era, it had the highest population density in the world, including India, China, wherever you want to compare it, the highest population density. Majority were, you know, Jews just off the boat. And it's gone through so many reincarnations in the last 110 years, 120 years. And it sort of bottomed out, from the 70s to the late 80s, when it was just a giant, dangerous sort of like drug souk, you know. And then Giuliani came in, and it was Giuliani time, which means if anybody so much as lights up a menthol cigarette, lock them up. And real estate needed a place to go. And real estate is the greatest crime fighter. And so now you have apartments down there where 20 years ago you had a line around the block of people and up the stairs to score heroin. You know, you got two generation, the fourth generation yuppies living there in a floor through that cost them over $1 million.
But why was it? I mean, you describe buying gelato with your daughters and them having no idea that they, too, were five generations removed from this place. That was where. What was it that finally made you think, this is really what I want my next book to be about, this landscape?
Well, I always wanted to write about the Lower East Side. I think it's the in American history, I think it's the singularly most important neighborhood in American history. The whole point, you got off the boat, you got in there, and from the day you got in there, you tried to figure out how to get the hell out. But the irony for me is in its latest reincarnation, which is this sort of like, Hipparati playground, you know, so you got the children, the middle class, upper middle class children, from anywhere from Scarsdale to Winnetka to points west. And, you know, they're all floating around. And for some of them, especially the ones that are closer to the city where they grew up, their great-grandparents were down there about 100 feet from where they just bought that $200 Che Guevara T-shirt, fighting for their lives. I mean, it was a vicious, brutal place, which gets very sentimentalized, you know. It's like, my Bubba, you know, it stunk. It was a savage, desperate place. And now the fifth generation's back there, like going to the Pink Pony with fake IDs, you know, to get like chocolatinis, and they're sitting in a coffee house with a laptop, and you know their great grandfather's ghost is just standing there pulling, you know, not pulling its hair out, but when in the 80s, when I got a loft like a little bit above Houston Street, which is the northern boundary of the Lower East Side, and it was kind of a funky loft, but still it was like way you moved if you were like a certain type of person and you were cool. And I told my grandfather, you come down to Great Jones and see my loft. And he wouldn't. He says, what are you, mocking me? I spent my whole life trying to get out of there. And now you're moving back? Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. Well, it takes us a while in the book to realize that is how you're going to tie all those disparate things together. The character that probably does that, the person that you're using, is this Eric Cash, who is this 35-year-old manager of a restaurant who all he can think of is that he's, as you call, one of these hyphenated names. He was going to be a writer, going to be an actor, but he's too old now to actually claim that he's going to do any of that stuff. Before we get to him, though, you set up, there's a prologue in this book, which actually, when you read the prologue, we don't really realize at that point where this book is going. Why did you decide, and you're going to read from that, but why did you decide to start with this prologue?
They're on the Lower East Side, the crime, it's gone from the most dangerous to the safest precinct in New York. And the police in the 7th Precinct, it's also the tiniest precinct in New York. I think it's 0.7 miles in diameter. And the police pretty much have been reduced to what they call quality of life squads, which is basically, the big crimes there are, you know, kids from the projects putting on nice conservative clothes, going into restaurants and waiting for some hammered yuppie to go to the bathroom without their purse, and then they get the purse and they walk out. That's a big crime then, you know, or bogus Pierre Cardin things, Ex-Lax watches or whatever. You know, it's not, but, you know, like, life is life, and it's New York City, so anything can happen, thank God, because otherwise I wouldn't have had the book. But one of the things they do is they have a quality of life squad. It's sort of four beefy guys in a taxi that's not a taxi. And what they do is they sit on the Williamsburg Bridge where goes from Brooklyn and empties out into the Lower East Side. And they sit there and they racially profile. I mean, they sit there, and if they see two heads that look likely, they get right behind it. And if these kids start driving, you know, very politely, you know, like doing these signals they haven't done since 1958, they know they're dirty. And they get the kids, and they just, it's a 1 in 3 shot. Somebody has pot on them. And they, if nothing else, they get overtime. But you also need, here's the deal, you're in a precinct that you know, you get screwed by your own good work, because if there's no crime, when the station commander gives his report into One Police Plaza, it looks like he didn't do anything. So you got to generate numbers. You got to show you're busy. And so these guys get, I mean, there's one guy got arrested for doing Tai Chi 5:30 in the morning because his park didn't open up until 6. So he's trespassing. He was also 83 years old.
Okay, so you're going to read from this prologue, which basically features the Quality of Life Patrol, who appear all through the book. They can be alternately really funny, and then they can, like, snap on a dime and turn, like, really hard-ass, basically.
Oh, yeah, okay, I can say ass then. All right.
yes, I'm laying the groundwork
for you.
This is just
like I through the book, I come back to this Quality of Life squad, you know, making these, like, sort of dopey arrests. They're kind of like the Greek chorus for the book, because they just honeycomb the whole turf of the book, and they periodically keep – they're like the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of the book. So there are four guys, Lugo, Daly, Scharf, and Gehagen. It's like 900 pounds of white beef in a taxi that's not a taxi. And they just saw a car coming over from Brooklyn, which they kind of like the shape of the heads in there. So now they're trailing this car. What do we got? Two males in the front. What do we got? Neon trim on the plate. Tinted windows. Right rear taillight. Front passenger just stuffed something under the seat. Thank you. Lugo hit the misery lights, climbs up the Honda's back, the driver taking a half block to pull over. Daly and Lugo slowly walk up on either side of the car, cross-beam the front seats. The driver, a young green-eyed Latino, rolls down his window. Officer, what'd I do? Lugo rests his cross arms on the open window, as if it's a backyard fence. License and registration, please? For real, what'd I do? You always drive like that? His voice almost gentle. Like what? Signaling lane changes, all road courteous and crap. Excuse me? Come on, nobody does that unless they're nervous about something. Well, I was. Nervous? You was following me. A cab was following you? Yeah, okay, a cab. Passing over his papers. All serious, officer, and no disrespect intended. Maybe I can learn something here, but what I do? Primary, you have neon trim on your plates. I had him put it there. This is my sister's whip. Secondary, your windows are too dark. I told her about that. Tertiary, you cross the solid yellow to get around a double parked car. Quadrary, you're sitting by a hydrant. That's because you just pull me over. Lugo takes a moment to assess the level of mouth he's getting. As a rule, he is soft-spoken, leaning into the driver's window to conversate, to explain, his expression baggy with patience, going eye to eye as if to make sure what he's explicating here is being digested, seemingly deaf to the obligatory sputterings, the misdemeanors of verbal abuse. But if the driver says that one thing, goes one word over some invisible line, then without any change of expression, without any warning signs, except maybe a slow straightening up, a sad, disgusted looking off, he steps back, reaches for the door handle, and the world as they knew it is no more. But this kid isn't too bad. This is for your own benefit. Get out of the car, please. As Lugo escorts the driver to the rear bumpers, Daly leans into the shotgun seat window and tilts his chin at the passenger. The second kid sitting there, affecting comatosity, heavy-lidded under a too-big baseball cap and staring straight ahead as if they were still driving somewhere. So what's your story? Daly says, opening the passenger door, offering this one some sidewalk, too, as Gehagen, all tatted out in Celtic braids, knots, and crosses, leans in to search the glove compartment, the cup caddy, the tape storage bin, Scharf taking the rear seats. Back at the rear bumper, the driver stands in a scarecrow tee, looking off soul-eyed as Lugo, squinting through his own cigarette smoke, finger-walks his pockets, coming up with a fat roll of 20s. This is a lot of cheddar, cuz. Counting it, then stuffing it into the kid's shirt pocket before continuing the pat-down. Yeah, well, that's my college tuition money. What the hell, college takes cash? Lugo laughs. Then finished, gestures to the bumper. Have a seat. Burke Technical in the Bronx? It's new. And they take cash? Money's money. True dat, Lugo shrugs, just waiting out the car search. So what's your major? Furniture management? You ever been locked up before? Oh, come on, man. My uncle's like a detective in the Bronx. Like a detective? No, a detective. He just retired. Oh, yeah? What precinct? I don't know, per se. 69th? The fighting 69th, Gehagen calls out, feeling under the passenger seat now. There is no 69th, Lugo says, flicking his butt into the gutter. 60 cents, 60-something, I said I wasn't sure. What's his name? Rodriguez in the Bronx? That narrows it down. What's his first name? Narciso? Don't know him. Had a big retirement party? Sorry. I've been thinking of trying out for the police academy myself. Oh, yeah, that's great. Hey, Donnie. DeHagen backs out of the passenger door, holds up a Ziploc of weed. Cause we need more smoke hounds. The kid closes his eyes, tilts his chin to the stars, to the moon over Delancey. His or yours, Lugo gestures to the other kid on the sidewalk, face still blank as a mask. His pockets strewn over the car hood. Somebody needs to say or you both go. Mine, the driver finally mutters. Turn around, please. Oh, man, you're going to lock me up for that? Hey, 2 seconds ago you stepped up like a man. Stay with that. Lugo cuffs him, then turns him forward again, holding him at arm's length as if to assess his outfit for the evening. Anything else in there? Tell us now. We'll rip that hoopty to shreds. Damn, man, I barely had that. All right, then, just relax, guiding him back down to the bumper as the search continues nonetheless. The kid looks off, shakes his head, mutters, sorry, ass. Excuse me? Now, I'm just saying, purse in his mouth in self-disgust, not about you. DeHagen comes back with the baggie, hands it over. Okay, look. Lugo lights another cigarette, takes a long first drag. This? We could give a damn. We're out here on a higher calling. He nods at a passing patrol car, something the driver said making him laugh. You know what I'm saying? More serious stuff? There you go. That's all I got. I'm not talking about what you got. I'm talking about what you know. What I know? You know what I'm saying. They both turn and look off in the direction of the East River, two guys having a moment, one with his hands behind his back. Finally, the kid hails heavily. Well, I can tell you where a weed spot is. You're kidding me, right? Lugo wheels back. I'll tell you where a weed spot is. I'll tell you where 50 is. I can get you better stuff than this for half what you paid 7 days a week with blindfolds on. The kid sighs, tries not to look at the barely curious locals coming out of the Banco de Ponce ATM Center and the Dunkin' Donuts, the college kids hopping in and out of taxis. Come on, do right by me, I'll do right by you. Lugo absently tosses the baggie from hand to hand, drops it, picks it up. Do right like how? I want a gun. A what? I don't know a gun. You don't have to know a gun, but you know someone who knows someone, right? Oh, man. For starters, you know who you bought this stuff from, right? I don't know any gun, man. You got $40 of weed there. I paid for it with my own money because it helps me relax, helps me party. Everybody I know is like, go to work, go to school, get high, that's it. Huh. So, like, there's no one you could call and say, yo, I just got jacked into PJs. I need me a one-time whistle. Can I meet you at such and such? A whistle? Lugo makes a finger gun. Oh, you mean a hammer. A hammer, a whistle. Lugo turns away and tightens his ponytail. Pfft, the kid looks off then. I know a knife. Lugo laughs. My mother knows a knife. This one's used. Forget it. Then chin tilting to the other kid. What about your sidekick there? My cousin? He's like half retarded. How about the other half? Ah, oh, come on. The driver lolls his head like a cow. Another patrol car rolls up, this one to pick up the prisoner. All right, just think about it, okay? Lugo says. I'll see you back in the holding in a few hours. What about my car? Gilbert Grape there. He's got a license? His brother does. Well, tell him to call his brother and get his ass down here before you wind up towed. Damn. I'm calling out. Raymond, you hear that? The cousin nods, but makes no move to retrieve his cell phone from the car hood. So, you never answered my question, Lugo says, skull steering him into the rear of the cruiser. You ever been locked up before? The kid turns his head away, murmurs something. It's okay, you can tell me. I said yes. For? The kid shrugs, embarrassed, says this. Yeah? Around here? Uh-huh. How long back? On Christmas Eve. On Christmas Eve for this? Lugo winces. That is cold. Who the hell would... Do you remember who collared you? Uh-huh. The kid mutters, then looks Lugo in the face. You.
Richard Price... reading from his eighth novel, Lush Life. You know, you end up playing a really kind of funny cat and mouse game with the reader, because you get us to meet the muggers and the future murderer several times, even before, like, anything really happens. And the first encounter that is memorable is when they're paid to pick up a bunch of kind of stuff that's fallen down in a collapsed synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
And you obviously are having a really good time, like, trying to set up this. It is thrillerish in that we know, not at that point, that these guys are up to no good. But even when we find out that one of them has murdered
one of the three guys that are out, you know, carousing for a night. You keep placing the murderer in front of the reader, like all through the book. And so if there is a thriller aspect, it's, are they ever going to get this guy? You obviously have a really good time just like sort of toying with us.
Well, I mean, the whole point is to humanize what people would think of as inhuman. I mean, you know, not to sound like some stinking liberal, but, I mean, you know, nobody's born a perp. You know, you're born into a family, and you're born into an environment, and you're born into a point in history, you know. And, I'm not law and order, you know, but I'm not like a weenie either, you know, about crime and punishment. But, you know, it's like any cop can tell you. It's like, you know, these kids that they lock up, any one of them that has the slightest bit of a philosophical bent says the same thing, man. If I was born in this kid's crib, I mean, dead but for the grace of God go I. I mean, you know, stuff people do is, I'm a big fan of nurture over nature.
Well, and Tristan, who is the kid who, not unlike Eric Cash, both of them, I mean, Tristan's this young kid from a project, horrible, abusive family, you know, only wants to fit in, only wants some power. Eric Cash, 35, also only wants to fit in. They actually have a lot in common, those two, in terms of, like, wanting somehow to be empowered in their lives. The thing that empowers Tristan is a gun. He gets a gun, and it changes his life.
Well, I mean, as a kid, I mean, you know, it's he's so quiet and he's so beat down and he's so burned out. And when this is not really giving anything away because it's sort of like you can figure this out pretty quick. When he kills this guy, he didn't even mean to do it. It was like a fight or flight reaction. He just squeezed the trigger, and all of a sudden, he feels like he did something. And it's not like he's going to go out and kill more people, but it's like he's got this secret, even at one point, and nobody knows this. And even at one point, I say he always thought of himself as invisible, but he never thought of his invisibility as a superpower. You know, Richard Wright in Native Son pretty much, you know, did this kind of same thing, except it was Native Son and he was Richard Wright, so, you know. He did the same thing with Bigger Thomas. He took an incredibly sort of beat down guy who discovers himself through an act of violence. You know, it doesn't last very long. You know, it's not like he goes on to, you know, get a Cadillac dealership or anything. But, you know, it's this awful way of coming into your own.
You've set up this character, Ike Marcus, the one who gets killed. And, I mean, he becomes part of the story really very briefly. But it's his father, Billy, who becomes one of really the lightning rods in this story on so many different levels. And I guess that you had to cut 200 pages out of this book at one point.
Yeah.
And the calf, as you call it, when your book calved, most of that was about this dad, Ike Marcus, who uses this murder, doesn't use it, but it's literally undone by this murder. And you seem to have, if you have affinity with the characters in the book, Maddie, the policeman, the detective Yolanda, who's his detective with him, it's really Billy Marcus who seems to have brought out something personal in you.
Well, I have these two awful kids, you know. No, I'm not kidding. Anybody who has kids, you know, it's probably the biggest thing that'll ever happen to you until, you know, you're wearing adult Pampers at any rate. Or I call them Grampers. And the whole notion of what would happen if, God forbid, dot, dot, dot. And it's a place that you don't want to go in your imagination. But once you're there, you know, you try to think of this, what it would be like, you know. And so I created this father who had lost his son to a murderer, who lives in Riverdale, which is a northern suburb. It's the people in Riverdale never say they live in the Bronx, even though technically they do. They say it's like, you know, lower Manhattan, lower North Manhattan or North Bronx, Riverdale. And he winds up going down to the Lower East Side after his son's dead. And it's kind of like, you know, if two animals are mates and one of them dies, the other one can't leave, and it just winds and goes in circles, and that's what the father becomes. And I spent the whole book trying to write a character who's mad, who's in shock, and who's non-sequitorious, and is slowly trying to make something out of it. But the span of the book is only like a couple of weeks, and it's going to take a couple of years before this guy regains any kind of semblance of mind.
On that note, we're going to take just a short break here, just a couple minutes. We're going to be back with Richard Price and Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. Thank you.
You're listening to 98.7 WFMT Chicago and to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, a series featuring conversations with noteworthy authors who've published recent works of fiction or nonfiction. This local broadcast is made possible in part by MavenChronicles.com. Let them take you somewhere, and by Seminary Co-op Bookstores. For readers, the Seminary Co-op Bookstores are a literary slice of heaven, because this consumer-owned bookstore is actually three Chicago bookstores: the flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue, widely regarded as one of the world's best academic bookstores, carries about 200,000 titles. Currently, they recommend Martha Nussbaum's Liberty of Conscience, in defense of America's tradition of religious equality, just released by Basic Books. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a charming neighborhood bookstore that's featuring Franny Billingsley's first picture book, Big Bad Bunny, newly published by Simon & Schuster. And the Newberry Library Bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in cartography, music, history, cards, gifts, and more. Discover Mapping Manifest Destiny, Chicago and the American West by Michael Konzen and Diane Dillon, published by the Newberry Library. Enjoy Seminary Co-op Bookstore's 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, and author events. Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456 and semcoop.com. Each month, the featured author of Writers on the Record will be the subject of a brief Q&A written by Victoria Lautman for Chicago Magazine. Both the magazine and 98.7 WFMT will announce upcoming interviews, which take place Sundays at noon at Looking Glass Theater. Our next broadcast of Writers on the Record takes place Sunday, April 10th, when Victoria Lautman talks with Elizabeth Strout about her book, Olive Kitteridge. If you'd like to be in the audience for that discussion, call 312-832-6789 to make a reservation. Admission is free. We return now to Chicago's Looking Glass Theater and our live broadcast of Writers on the Record. Today, Victoria Lautman has been discussing the book Lush Life with its author, Richard Price.
Okay, welcome back to Writers on the Record. I want to remind everybody, put your calendars, put down on your calendars, April 20th, Elizabeth Strout, Alexander Heyman, May 18th. Those are the last two in the series. But we have Richard Price here today talking about Lush Life. And it's so interesting in this book because there's so many images that are photographic. And in fact, Jacob Riis, the famous late 19th century photographer who really cataloged the Lower East Side and is referenced in the book really up front, there's this really interesting character, Pauly, who is a culture dealer. I love the idea of this guy kind of traveling around with a suitcase and like, can I give you a first edition of Leaves of Grass? Look at this Jacob Riis photograph from your basement. This is an incredible character, and you obviously put some thought into him and the gear that he's trying to like flog.
Well, I mean, the whole notion is that, you know, when people reach a certain level of success and a certain age, they don't do drugs anymore. And sometimes, like the guys who used to sell dope in the 80s, they shift gears, and now the guy sells hot, you know, cultural artifacts, but he still has like a dope dealer ferret-like thing about him.
Do you know people like that? I mean, is there
a guy at Gotham Bookmart that I'm in trouble. there was a guy there who had his own secret stash of first editions, and he had all these Henry Millers, and he came up and like whispered to me, like, "You like Miller?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "Come here." You know, he just sort of snuck me into a corner in his big vast bookstore, and one of the other book workers came into the room. And he said, "Hey, what's up? Get out of here, I'm doing something." You know, and I got to leave. You know, and I wind up buying these, like, first edition Henry Millers. And I said, "Wow, I just feel like I scored some drugs." And one of the other guys says, "This guy used to have the best dope in the East Coast."
Well, I guess just the way, like, the characters have shifted in that, like, time span between dealing drugs and dealing these cultural artifacts. You seem to have used synagogues in the book as like a way of also detailing how that neighborhood of the Lower East Side has changed. One of the early scenes is the synagogue that's just like collapsed. It's just so old and decrepit, and people are picking through the remains. But the guy who runs Berkman's, who's this guy who set up this restaurant that Eric is working at, and so did Ike, the bartender, he's living in a deconsecrated synagogue, collecting these artifacts. I mean, he is such a fascinating character, too. And you obviously have used these synagogues kind of like bookends in the story.
Well, you know, the synagogues represent, you know, what was. And I'm not, you know, hyper-Jewish or anything like that. Basically, I only feel Jewish when I'm around anti-Semitism. Other than that, I could give a damn. But synagogues are like, you know, the alpha and the omega for this neighborhood. And the lives that some of these places have now is that they've been desanctified or deconsecrated, have been bought by, you know, somebody, you know, with a lot of bonus money, and gutted and turned into, you know, palazzos. And they keep certain artifacts. And, I mean, these places were built for, you know, working class schmegegs from like 100 years ago, and now you got this fabulous granite kitchen island where the Torah Ark used to be, and you know, you still have, you know, some of the Hebrew Zodiac paintings on the walls. And I've seen a couple of these places, you know, and there's a lot of ghosts.
The other thing that really strikes me in the book is that This is another good literary comparison. Forget Dostoevsky and Plato, but I'm going to compare you to J.K. Rowling here, in that there's this almost sense of invisibility between these two worlds of the, and you're going to describe one of these sections in a second. You know how the muggles live with these sorcerers in those books, and they're not aware of each other. These people are passing each other, the projects kids, the China people, the people who are on their way up trying to get out of the neighborhood are invisible to the people who are buying their way in. And moment of like where those two are made apparent to each other, that the problems are caused. And you're going to read a section where Maddie, the detective, and Yolanda go to what is called a boat building by Eric Cash because they're looking for people who can help identify the killer. And I think that particular place and your interest in how these different cultures come together is really completely solidified in that section.
Yeah, this is it. A lot of the Fujianese Chinese are living there, you know, really squashed into the same apartment. Nobody knows about them. They don't deal with anybody. But it's like this huge hidden population. And they look at the robbery pattern reports and they find out that some Chinese guy had been mugged in a circumstance very similar to the circumstances in which the kid was killed. So they're trying to find this Chinese guy. On the top floor of 24 East Broadway had only one apartment. This door slightly ajar, too. Maddie looking at Yolanda. Yolanda is his partner. Then pushing it wide as he knocked and droned. "Hello, police." His ID curled in his hand. First thing he saw stepping inside was a rough pyramid of men's shoes, maybe two dozen pairs, either black slip-ons or plastic shower clogs, stacked beneath a department store still life of buckshot pheasants and a powder horn. No one came to the door, but Asian Pop drifted from down the hall. "Hello, police," another desultory shout out, and then they began walking towards the music. The place was a modified railroad flat, basically a long central corridor flanked by rooms, most of which had been divided and divided again with sheetrock into cells, each with a foam mattress topped by a twist of sheets, save for two large rooms, one on either side of the hallway, both bare of furniture, other than what looked like extra-wide bookshelves bracketed into the walls in vertical stacks of three. On a few of these planks, men were either smoking in the dark or asleep, each man still awake, slowly rolling to face the wall as the detectives shadowed their doorway. The railroad ended in a wider kitchen where four of the men were sitting around a table eating something nesting in tiny shells and a broccoli-like green off sheets of newspaper, and a fifth was singing into a microphone while facing the monitor of a karaoke machine. On a former counter behind the dining table sat a fish tank holding a single carp so large that it couldn't turn around. Maddie thinking the damn thing must have lost its mind years ago. "How you doing?" he said, unnecessarily flashing his ID. The men nodded in greeting as if two police just strolling through the flat unannounced was business as usual, then turned their attention back to the singer. Only one short-limbed, compact guy, beaming and vigorous, flew out of the kitchen and returned with two more chairs. "Sit," pointing at the seats, then gesturing for them to check out the pipes on the guy with the mic. "Sit." "Not now," Maddie said, slow and loud. "We need to talk to Paul Eng." Then, "He's not in trouble." The karaoke song came to an end, the guy with the mic passing it to one of the others. "Sit," the energetic guy repeated, still beaming like the sun. "Where's Paul Eng?" Maddie blared flatly. "No." "No what?" The next man began his song, which sounded like a Chinese cover of Roy Orbison's Dream Baby. "No what?" "Maybe you're pronouncing it wrong," Yolanda offered. "No, I'm not. That's how that kid Fenton Ma says it." Then blaring, "Paul Eng. Jesus, you don't have to yell," Yolanda snapped. "They're not deaf. Fellas, stay with me on this. Who's Paul Eng?" The men had no reaction except to look from the singer to the cops with expectant grins, as if to see whether they dug him. "What's your name?" Yolanda asked the chair carrier. "Me?" The guy laughed. "No." "No? Your name's No?" "Huh?" "Dr. No," Yolanda said. "What's his name?" Maddie pointed to the singer. "Good, huh?" Maddie turned to Yolanda. "Are they playing us?" She shrugged, squinted at the fish. "Look, we're going to come back and come back and come back until..." "Okay." The chair carrier waved goodbye, still smiling. "Let's just come back with Bobby O," Yolanda said. "O's Korean." "Okay, we'll bring that kid Fenton Ma in." They left the apartment without another word, but before they could start down the stairs, that compact chair carrier came out into the hallway and, grabbing Maddie's arm, beckoned for them to follow him up the short stairs that led to the roof door. The landing up there wedge-shaped beneath the slant of the eaves and littered with discarded vials, matches, burnt spoons, and needles. Standing a few steps above the police, the guy then went into a brisk, efficient mime of shooting up, stabbing a forearm with his thumb, saying, "Psht," then acting out the woozy stagger of some kind of bellicose junkie. "Ah, you fight me, psht, ah." "Well, what the hell does he expect?" Maddie said, keeping his street door open like that. "You come more," the guy said. "Yeah, we'll keep an eye out," Yolanda said mildly. "Have a good night now."
You really kind of feel for these cops and detectives down there. It reminds me of teachers in a lot of schools who say, you know, "I'm trying to handle my first grade class and there's 9 languages." And in this book, I mean, it's really the police that have to try and figure out how to deal with each of these populations. And they're, you know, there's this, well, you decided there's going to be like, what, 5-6 worlds that you're going to dip into?
Well, see, the whole book should be subtitled "When Worlds Collide," because here's what's going on down here. You got this real estate explosion. So you got all these young, affluent, primarily white kids, but not exclusively. You've got the housing projects world, which is black and Hispanic. You got the unrehabbed tenements that real estate hasn't gotten to yet. And they're a combination of Hispanic, Chinese, black, and then you got the Orthodox Jews that are down there in the co-ops. You got a whole bunch of other people, and then you got this enormous hidden population of Fujianese Chinese that is probably the second highest population group, and nobody deals with anybody. Nobody acknowledges anybody's existence until 3 in the morning. You know, when some of these kids want to flash a gun on Ludlow Street, scare some white kids into giving them $20 and go getting Chinese takeout.
Well, and at the procedural part of this, the police procedural part, which is fascinating to, you know, those of us who really don't know anything about it, the idea is to keep this murder on the front page as long as possible, because after 5 days, it's going to get kicked to the back with the real estate ads.
Well, what will happen is the police will try to get a kick to the back. If they know that this horse has left the barn and we ain't catching it, they're going to try to get it kicked to page five, like, ASAP. I mean, how they're going to do that is they're going to put a press gag on it. Because if we don't talk to the police, there's nothing for them to say. If we talk to them and we say, well, still haven't found a guy, we're going to look bad, which means the police commissioner looks bad. And more importantly, the mayor looks bad. The mayor is going to call a police commissioner. Media is a tail that wags a dog with crime. Anything that gets media coverage, everybody's, 24/7 on the job. There was a situation. I'll give you an example. I mean, there was a situation. The Orthodox Jewish community is very powerful down there because there's about two or three guys, rabbis and such, that can deliver 15,000 votes in an election. And so the police in the Lower East Side, they even have what they call, it's sort of like a little secret. It's called the J Squad. Sheldon Silver lives there, state assemblyman. That is a very politically potent, subdivision down there. And I remembered on Delancey, some guy coming out of an OTB was beaten near to death, jumped on by a bunch of junkies. And the word got back that the guy was laying there likely to die. And the word got to the detective squad that the guy's name was Schwartz. Man, that place emptied out like that. Pew! And when they got down there, they realized the guy's name was Schultz. And they went, ah, the hell with it. And they went back.
There's a character like that in the book. I was like the big mocker for the Jewish. Yeah, and he gets Maddie in a apartment.
I mean, every ethnic group has their equivalent. Chinatown has their guy. J-Town has their guy. Like the black communities have their guys. There's some people you just got to hop to it.
So much of your, you had the whole Dempsey, the fictional town of Dempsey from your earlier books and Samaritan and Clockers and all these places. And they refer very specifically to projects which are also evoked much, as actual places in this book. And it's really interesting that you came from a project yourself in the Bronx, but at a time when you said, you were like this nice Jewish kid growing up in the Bronx. When
it was not like, nice.
He'd like us to think he's bad, but he's really nice. And you talked about at that time that these were launching pads for people, but that now they are terminals. And that was kind of like the last gasp of a project being really a middle-class settlement where all these people could live together, not where basically families went to die.
I'd say up until the mid to late 60s, projects did what they were designed to do, which is provide affordable housing to working-class people so the next generation would not need to live in a housing project. And it pretty much worked. I mean, I know there's somebody in the audience that grew up with me and was my girlfriend when I was 4. And then picked some other guy. So when I was 4 1/4, so I threw myself down a flight of stairs. But we won't talk about that. And at that time, they were racially integrated. They were religiously integrated. It was a working class neighborhood, but drugs were unheard of. Divorce was a little like scandalous. And everybody of my generation either went to college or to the police academy or into construction with a powerful union. Or went into, not in the army, unless they were drafted because Vietnam was going on. But, everybody kind of went on and had a functional life. And then I don't want to blame Reagan, but it's like between Reaganomics and the rise of the drug economy and the cutting off of options and white flight, the projects became overnight ghettos. And like in my particular projects, everybody who could, black and white, bailed as soon as this place, Co-op City, opened up. They had 15,000 apartments, and you could buy a co-op for $2,000. And everybody in my building who could, because, people in the projects, they want to get out of there, but they don't have the money to go anywhere, and Co-op City was the perfect answer. And overnight, it turned into an instant ghetto. When aspiring people finally move out, the people that move in after them are probably people that were further down. But between white flight, Reaganomics, and the rise of the drug culture, and especially the rise of crack in the late 80s or mid 80s, those places went to hell. I don't know if they're making a comeback now. I mean, the projects I grew up are still pretty decent. Probably because there's a lot of senior citizens there. I don't think they can't be as horrible as they were in the '80s, you know, because you know the world isn't as awful, or the urban world isn't as awful, but it's just they're different. The only thing I recognize are the bricks.
If anybody's interested in asking a question, this is a good time to come up to one of the microphones. We'll try and get in a few questions before the end. Do not be shy. We like to have questions. Yeah, get on down here. Okay, so I know, are a bunch of you big Wires fan? The Wire? Yeah. Woo! So tonight's the last one, as everybody knows. And it's interesting, if you're not familiar with The Wire, or you're only familiar with Richard's books, the style of it, this kind of dip in, dip out, this rhythm that is just, it's so fast-paced, but it's almost like you're jump cutting in your books constantly, the way it's jump cutting in The Wire. And I wondered, I mean, I know that was a show that was very much influenced, set up, it couldn't exist without Clockers.
Well, yeah, David Simon said the whole thing was based on Clockers, and he had me come in the third year to write. But
did I take your question away? Sorry. No. You have to do that in the microphone because nobody can hear you. Thanks.
Hi, I just wanted to ask about The Wire because we're so disappointed it's going off the air, and I wanted to know how the writing experience was there. Did you just have to follow the story? You know, did you contribute to it? Was it a collaborative effort between the people that worked on it?
That's enough.
And all that stuff.
All right. Well, basically, it's not TV. It's HBO. Actually, it's not HBO. It's The Wire. I've written for The Wire, and so I don't really feel like I've had an experience writing for TV. I mean, because it's such a singular show. It was an assembly line of 12 episodes, and so when you wrote episodes 3 and 8, you were locked in exactly. You could not deviate because you had to go right from 1 and 2 perfectly and set up 4. And so you could not decide to kill somebody or get somebody pregnant, you know, because, you know, it was like writing in a phone booth. But, I mean, it was good, though. I liked it. I mean, I have a 3-day story meeting. You leave it a bunch of index cards. You got to do this with Omar. You got to do this with City Hall. You got to, you know, and the only spin, the only wiggle room you have there is in humor or you know, dialogue. But, you know, everybody knows what's going to be delivered before it's even written.
We have another question, too. Thanks.
I truly enjoy your books, and I am a stinking liberal. And I do work in prison reform, and that more or less came out of Reaganomics. But to get away from that, The Samaritan was wonderful, and I did want to know how much that came out of your own life story, and were you ever beaten up in that way?
Not yet, but ask me about 2 hours from now. Well, you know, they always say, you know, a conservative is a liberal who's gotten beaten up.
Yes.
But no, I didn't need to do that research. I didn't, you know, I had my mother. I didn't, you know, but no, it was somewhat autobiographical, but it was fiction.
Thank you. Over here.
Thanks for coming out and sharing yourself with us. You've always obviously been through a lot. I guess I'm always interested in creativity. I wondered if you'd share with us how writing sort of became a part of what you do, how that evolved and kind of what it's meant for you and how that kind of started up.
Oh, so we have 2 hours.
Yeah, I was going to say, here are the easy questions. Dude.
No, I always wanted to be a writer. Let me just do the speed chess answer. I always wanted to be a writer. My grandfather was a factory worker, but he wrote poetry that was published on a mimeograph. You probably haven't heard the word mimeograph in 25 years. YMHA Journal in Brooklyn. My father was kind of mind blown to see his father in print writing his poetry. And I just wanted some of that admiration. So I always wanted to be a writer. So I was always writing. I mean, when you're a teenager, you pick, everybody's got to have like an ace in a sleeve because we all hate ourselves as teenagers. So one guy's like the best hair, one guy's the best dancer, one guy's the math brain, and I was the writer.
You got hair, too.
Oh, yeah.
You got the good hair. But you also said that you were known, before you were known as the writer, you were known as the big word guy when you were like 8.
Yeah, I was like the big reader, you know, it's like, otherwise known as the mope, you know. But I do remember, like, anytime there was ever a word that nobody understood in second or third grade, they would say, hey, Price, what's this? And I saw this word, schedule, and I never saw it before either. And some kids said, what is that word? And God forbid I should ever say, I don't know. I said, schedule. Next.
Let's see if we can get in a few more questions.
I just know you from your conversation today. I grew up in New York City, know the Bronx and Manhattan. I think you use your books, though, it seems, to really bring out issues of, like, our cultural amnesia, not wanting to face certain things about what's going on in our world, like we turn away. And you kind of were portraying in this book real estate kind of being the alpha omega, and I kind of see that in Chicago with real estate transformation. I'm wondering are we just don't want to face reality?
Well, I mean, one of the themes of the book very quickly is real estate is violence, transition of any kind, even for like a better world, it's violence. And what I do in my books is, if I could be a camera, if I could have a camera implanted in my forehead and just turn my ear and it would snap, I'd never write a word. I'm a photorealist, and basically what I do in my books is not press an agenda, but bear witness. And I'll lay it out for you. I'll say, this is what I see, and then you decide what you're going to take out of it.
A question, sir?
So we've been talking a lot about, like, urban structure and also about Reaganomics and the things that have happened since the 70s and 80s. So I wanted to ask, do your novels have any kind of politics? And if they do, what are those politics?
Well, like I said, it pretty much the same thing. It's like my personal politics is I'm an old liberal. But I'm not going to impose. I think, if you want to send a message, go to Western Union. I'm not going to impose any kind of message on my book. I'm going to see what I see. I'm going to lay it out before you. And if you feel outraged, fine. You know, if you feel, I've had reactions. I've had, conservative blogs have come off like, yeah, yay, somebody finally put people in their place, and then I've had other reactions where people say, this guy is telling us that, that how real estate is wreaking havoc on existing third world communities, but me telling you what to think is not going to do anything. I'm just going to lay it out.
No judgment.
I feel so shallow asking this question after all these other questions, but when I first heard the title of your book, I thought of the Billy Strayhorn song, and mm-hmm. Is it true that it is from the song, and is it true that you regret having entitled the book Lush Life?
Well, the book's been getting such good reviews, I don't regret a damn thing. I mean, I could have called it Slap My Ass and Call Me Mary. I mean, what's it, it's just... Who had Annie and a Fanny with a flounder? I mean, I called it Lush Life because I just love the title of the Billy Strayhorn song. And I was thinking Lush Life meaning the abundance of life and culture and also the irony of that of a murder at the center. And then, only then, did I actually see the lyrics to the Billy Strayhorn song. And so it was this very melancholy song about ladies who cocktail at noon, at these old Third Avenue bars. And I went, whoops. But I just still love the phrase.
You've got a whole lot of other stuff going on now. I mean, this book becoming this huge hit, I don't know if you can ever expect that. I mean, getting Michiko Kakutani to, like, rave about it. Wow. But you've already got, like, another book in the hopper. You've got another movie coming up. You've been assigned like a bunch of stuff. So how is this going to change anything for you, one way or the other?
Well, I don't have any book ideas, and after getting good reviews like this, I just figure it's over. There's no way I'm going to write a book. This is as good as it's going to get. But I'm 5 years between books, so it's not even. I don't even have an idea for a book. I have a script I'm doing based on this Russian thriller for Ridley Scott, and I just did it because it just seemed like so. I've never done anything like that before, but it's, beware what you wish for. It was hard. And I'm supposed to do a TV pilot for FX, and it's about, yikes, the Lower East Side. I wonder how that happened. And other than that, I'm just going to be writing a lot of checks.
Well, we will look forward in 5 to 8 years for your next book, and very much looking forward to it. Thank you. Lush Life is fantastic.
You're
Richard
welcome.
Price, thank you. You're listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Loudon. Thanks a lot.
The people at Maven Chronicles and at Seminary Co-op Bookstores Hope you've enjoyed today's broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, which will return on Sunday, April 20th, when Victoria's guest will be Elizabeth Strout, author of Olive Kitteridge. If you'd like to be in the audience for that discussion, call 312-832-6789 to make a reservation. Admission is free. Our special thanks to everyone at Looking Glass Theater, including Executive Director Rachel Kraft and House Manager Chad Wachob. Thanks also to Chicago Magazine, including Editor Richard Babcock. Eric Arunas is the audio engineer for Writers on the Record. Steve Robinson is the executive producer. The host and producer for Writers on the Record is Victoria Lautman. Broadcasts of Writers on the Record are made possible, in part, by MavenChronicles.com. Let them take you somewhere. And by Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456. This is 98.7 WFMT Chicago and WFMT.com. After more than 50 years, Ico's Art Materials will be closing its doors forever in early April of this year. Almost all items are currently discounted 20% or more. Ico's beautiful papers, books, folk arts, and crafts are selling quickly. Come in early for the best selection. Ico's Art Materials, for beautiful Japanese paper and fine handcrafted items to inspire and delight, is located at 3347 North Clark Street in Chicago. 773-404-5600.